hearing you're concerned about my happiness. But all the thought you're giving me is conscience, I guess. If I were walking in your shoes, I wouldn't worry enough. Are you and your friends the world about me? I'm having lots of fun. Counting flowers on the wall, that don't bother me at all. Playing solitaire till dawn with the deck of 51. Smoking cigarettes and watching Captain Kangaroo. Now don't tell me I've nothing to do. Last night I dressed in tails, pretended I was on the tank.
You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. And now, here's Ian Punnett.
Please don't give a thought to me. I'm really doing fine.
All indications are good for Art's return next week on Coast to Coast AM. And never having suffered from any chronic back pain, I can only imagine what Art's been going through. But it does not, according to the reports I get, sound like fun. And when I spoke to him about it last week, he didn't sound like a guy who was ready to get back to work. So I am overjoyed to hear that he's feeling better. Who left it? Who left it? This treasure in this cave that Glenn Kimball is going to tell us about. How did he find it? And what does the discovery mean? If you don't know this story, you don't want to miss this show, because armed guards are standing at the ready, protecting this site until the excavation can begin, and you'll hear about it first coming up next. On Coast to Coast AM, in for Art Bell, my name's Ian Punnett. Incidentally, I've been thinking about Glenn Kimball lately. Hey, Glenn.
I've been thinking about you too, Ian.
No, I mean this quite seriously. I was taking a summer school course at seminary on the Christology of the later fathers. And what should come in so perfectly handy but the gift you sent me last year of the book of ecclesial history from Eusebius. And so, even as we speak, in the
I saved you textbook costs.
More importantly, you gave me some fresh insight on stuff that was really interesting. And I had in my I don't know how it happened, but somewhere along the line, from using that book, I found that while I had been studying in class with some other textbooks, I had used my Glenn Kimball bookmark, Hidden Stories of the Childhood of Jesus bookmark, that had been in this book. And so I've been literally looking at your name now for about 2 weeks in a row. And so when they should happen to mention that you are good to go for a show on these caves in southern Illinois, I felt like I had already been communing with you mentally for quite some time. So I hope all has been well with you.
It has been. You know, Ian, you had a caller in your last hour that said something.
I knew you were
going to
miss
it.
Well, go ahead.
And it's going to lead into this topic very nicely.
Okay.
The caller asked you, is there any evidence?
I knew you were going to talk about it. I knew you were going to mention that.
I'm going to have to catch you, Ian.
No. I even as I was saying that, I go, Glenn's going to have some billion-year-old text that nobody has seen in the light of day. Even as I was saying it, I'm like, Glenn is going to dispute this. But anyway, go ahead. You were hearing the caller ask about whether there was any other evidence about the Exodus.
About the Exodus and Moses crossing the Red Sea and drowning the Pharaoh. Well, Jim Long and Vindel Jones has some excellent, excellent film footage about a very unknown, very obscure hieroglyphic compilation on a piece of stone, which describe in detail Moses crossing the Red Sea and Moses following him into the Red Sea, or excuse me, Pharaoh following him into the Red Sea and being killed when the Red Sea drowned all of his troops. And by the way, the thing that leads us into this topic is that this little teeny, it wasn't little teeny, but it's a horizontal inscription was being used as a stone watering trough for goats. The film footage will be used on my program here in the next year.
Well, I would love to see that, and I'd like to see the dating on that too.
And we'll let Vindel and Jim Long. Jim Long's so spectacular because he's got some great stuff in a can that's wonderful. But the interesting thing is that there are many, many, many precious things that are being used very commonly.
Well, that's for sure, and people don't realize their value. Because, as in the case of we've seen with the Rosetta Stone, sometimes they don't even know what is written on it. And so I have no doubt that there are some treasures in the ancient attic somewhere in North Africa that could shed further light on that subject, too. But how does that play into the caves of Illinois?
Well, I wanted to say two things before we get into the actual discovery of the caves. But there... First of all, Lisa probably led you a little bit astray in that there's not armed guards at this moment, but there will be after they pour the concrete. They have to open the cave. These caves are, the cave itself is a limestone cave about 30 feet straight down. What we have done is we've taken electromagnetic survey equipment from large mining group and done a survey of the ground, and we have found some time ago, Burroughs Cave discovery, we found 10 additional caves, limestone caves with vertical metal objects in them. Now, these vertical, that's not common for a limestone cave to have vertical metal objects in them. That's in fact, not only is that not common, that is next to impossible.
Well, but you, I think you, I dare say you're going too fast, though. But let's back up and talk about, for people that don't know about the Burroughs Caves, for people that don't know why this has been a pursuit for many, including a previous guest we had talking about ancient cities, lost cities, explain what the attraction was to this area and what the suspicion, what the suspicions have been about what has been there that has already been lost.
Well, you know, I taught at Southern Illinois University, and the thing that was most intriguing when I first arrived in Southern Illinois is they call that region Little Egypt, which includes Memphis, Tennessee, which is obviously named after Memphis, Egypt, and
Cairo.
And Cairo, Illinois. Well, they call it Cairo. I can't help but call it Cairo.
I understand.
I have no choice but to do that. And in asking around over a number of years of having lived there, I asked them why they called it Little Egypt. And there were a few naive people that says, well, this is a country that looks just like Egypt. And I go, no, it doesn't. It doesn't look anything like Egypt. Egypt's a desert, you know. This does not look like Egypt whatsoever, at least not in my mind, from what I've seen.
It sure doesn't look like Alexandria. Nothing against Carbondale, but...
Yeah, Carbondale does not look like Egypt in any way, shape, or form. But really, if you got digging into the archaeological history of Southern Illinois, you'll find out that the founding fathers of the towns had continuously run into Egyptian artifacts, petroglyphs, and other kinds of archaeological finds, which had found their way into private museums and private collections and have since basically dissipated, though we have photographs of a lot of those things from private collectors over the history of the, at least while I was teaching there, I got to see some of those kinds of things. In essence, this was very strange to find Egyptian artifacts, especially Egyptian hieroglyphs in Southern Illinois. And people have asked for a long time, how in the world did these things get here? And the explanation of that has eluded me until the last 5 years. Myself, I had no idea of how those things had gotten there. But to begin the story of the cave for a moment, obviously there was a gentleman who's very famous, and I won't use his name because I don't have his permission, but he was out searching in some of the open fields for Civil War artifacts right next to the intersection of the Ohio and Mississippi River on the Illinois side. And you know, those, you can find some excellent things in Civil War sites from time to time. Well, he ended up falling into a hole, literally, and in that hole they found and have photographed and documented in the Ancient American magazine some $8 million of gold coins with Cleopatra II's image on those. as well as busts of Mauritanian sailors, which are very, very prominent, very characteristic. You can tell exactly from whence they came. They came from the northern coast of Africa at a particular moment in history, right at the first century A.D. And then they found a bust of Christ as well, which is very interesting that you would find a bust of Christ in a cave from the first century, well up the Mississippi into Illinois, and other artifacts as well, which have since been taken into private museums, and many of those pictures still exist in the Ancient American magazine photographs. And in essence, this is an Ancient American magazine venture. It is their project. They have been wanting to do this. Wayne has been like a little kid. I just love Wayne. He is so excited. It's hard for him to sleep these days because he's wanted to go in. There's been into excavating the new found caverns for some time, and there has been some family problems and some political problems. And in the meantime, the owner of the property has died, and the inheritors of the property have. You know, there's been a lot of entanglements, and we won't get into that. And in addition, there's been a new law passed by Illinois that all the artifacts that are found in Illinois belong to the state of Illinois, which I think is a wonderful law, by the way, and should have been done a long time ago. And what was originally found in the original caves wouldn't have been dissipated and looted, as has been the case all over America. How many sites have been completely looted in America? We look, for example, at the Michigan tablets, which consisted of some 30,000-plus tablets, and what survives in our day is some 3,000 of those tablets. And from what I understand, a couple of tens of thousands of those went to a landfill and were crushed by D9 cats because some idiot up there from a museum said, well, Christopher Columbus discovered America, and none of this stuff can be real. It must have been forged. And I yelled at those guys, and I said, look, if you're going to forge something, you're going to forge one stone. Maybe a dozen. But 30,000 of them?
Right.
This is not likely, okay?
You'd have to be some sort of obsessive-compulsive hoaxer.
Yeah. I think I know some people like that, but I'm not sure they would go that far.
Even 30,000, so that's a lifetime of work right there.
Yeah, of course. And you know, so we... And there have been sites all over America and in South America that have been looted on the same basis. And we have followed the tradition of Christopher Columbus because that's the story in our common vernacular.
Sure.
That he discovered America. And the difference between Christopher Columbus and people who might have come here beforehand is very simple. Christopher Columbus was the only one who put a stake in the ground and said, mine, this belongs to Spain. A long time before Christopher Columbus, there were emigrations of a variety of many sorts that came to the Americas. Anthropologists are struggling over this because they have to fight their department heads to even get them published. People like Gunnar Thompson, who wrote the magnificent volume called The Lions in the New Land, which talks about the very foundation of emigrations to the Americas, and by the way, that's on our site, by the way, tonight, and there's only a few copies left in existence. That one's going out of print real fast. But there have been multiple visitations to this country, which is really helpful when we talk about the cave in Illinois, because if this were an isolated event where we found some Egyptian artifacts 30 feet down in a cave in Illinois and there were no other finds in America that would substantiate this kind of traffic in the Americas, we would logically presume that this would be likely a hoax. However, the fact that there have been multiple occurrences, and when I say multiple, I'm talking about dozens and dozens and dozens of artifact findings in this country which substantiate this kind of traffic in the Americas, then all of a sudden, the presumption swings the other way that maybe, in fact, something that we might find 30 feet under the ground in a limestone cave that has been buried for a very, very long time might very well be exactly what it reports itself to be.
Well, and in the Americas, as we've talked about in the show, and I think, although, as you rightly indicate, there is sort of a growing body of acceptance of this, it's still considered kind of a radical idea by some that the Americas were like the international terminal at O'Hare. that it was groups from many different places staking claims in parts of the Americas. Not just one group making return visits, but, you know, with the new evidence about the Chinese coming to the California coast and working their way down to Mexico, and of course, the Northern European visitors. I mean, there are all sorts of different ways in which this land was, you know, being crisscrossed by different peoples other than the Native Americans that were already here.
Well, we should have listened a long time ago, because people like Bartolome de las Casas, who followed Christopher Columbus not a decade later into the Americas, came here and became the hero right during the time Pizarro was massacring millions of Native American Indians. De las Casas became a hero to the American tribes because of his philanthropic work, and he was a Catholic priest. He wrote a terrific book, and he approached Oliver Cromwell in his day to say, said to him, "Oliver, in the Americas, there is a Judaic-Christian link in the Americas. These Indians cannot shut up about the coming of their Messiah. They cannot quit talking about their circumcisions and their commandments and all kinds of things which were very blatantly and openly matched up very closely with Judeo-Christian origins." And he begged Oliver Cromwell to re-enter and allow Jews to re-enter Wales in England. Because as you well know, you may not know this, but in history, Edward I, you saw the movie Braveheart.
Mm-hmm.
Longshanks was Edward I. He was a real
right.
Nice, sweet guy.
Sure was.
he's the one that threw all the Jews out of Wales during his era of time. And what was interesting is that he confiscated all of their artifacts, not the least of which was a very prominent piece of the cross of Christ. Now, you have to ask yourself, what are the Jews doing with a prominent piece of the cross of Christ? That always intrigued me. But it vindicates the story of St. Helena, the mother of Constantine, who had a piece of the cross of Christ. And when her son Constantine, who was the one who gave us the Nicene Council and the Bible, asked to have that cross of Christ taken to Constantinople, she refused. She says it belongs in England. It belongs there. And so when Edward I confiscated that, that vindicated the story of Helena and her tale of the cross of Christ. But the whole point of the matter is that the connection between specifically Great Britain and the Americas, and specifically the Judeo-Christian histories in the Americas, has been a cover-up for years. By the time of the Gutenberg Press, Wales was the only territory in the world that had the press banned for 200 years. Now, why would they ban the printing press in Wales, which was the house, was where the ancient Jews were kicked out by Edward I? Why would they ban the printing press? If we had not banned that printing press and destroyed and disseminated that Jewish population at that period of time, our history of the Americas would have been a lot broader, a lot more intense, and Christopher Columbus may not have been the hero we thought he was.
Oh, you know, it's amazing, though, that even in my time, even growing up when I did in schools, Christopher Columbus was turning into a hero with an asterisk at the end of his name. It was already, that had already changed. I was just talking with my kids about it the other day. They identify a bunch of people. They talk about Leif Erikson, they'll talk about the Vikings, they'll talk about, that they've already heard discussed as being the true link from the old world into the new world, not, you know, Christopher Columbus. But so far, it hasn't gone back to these ancient mariners that you're describing, and
Erickson was a Johnny come lately.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, so, but it's already pushed back that far. Now let's see how much further it'll go back eventually. This discovery that you're working on could obviously play a big part in pushing back the timeline for the next generation of school kids. And we're coming up on a break here, so I don't want to get too far into it, but I do want to ask you one quick question. And that is, the just so I make sure I have it straight, when is the excavation going to start? When are you going
to be
able to
do that? We targeted August 15th as the date of bringing in the digging equipment and pouring the concrete. So that's how close we are.
Okay. And when you're going to pour the concrete, what does that mean exactly?
Well, when you go down 30 feet into the ground, there's a very great danger of cave-ins. And so what you do is you pour concrete around the mouth of the cave so that keeps it from the dirt from dumping back in on your head.
And that's where we'll pick it up. Dirt on Glenn's head. Just a moment. How did these caves get the reputation that they have? We've heard about the coins with Cleopatra's face on it. We've heard about the bust of Christ. Who put them there, do we think? How did they get there? And were they coming back for them? What do we think we know about the story so far? And then, what do we think is going to be in these new caves coming up? With our guest Glenn Kimball in for Art Bell, my name's Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM. Kimball about the caves of southern Illinois, the excavation that should be beginning by mid-August. Any truth to the rumor that you've got a camera crew going in there with you, Glenn?
Big time.
Okay. Can you tell us about that?
If I could get you and Art out on a plane to come out, I'd get you a security pass.
Oh, hey, don't even... I get there... I'd come with my family in a heartbeat if I could. I'd get in a car. I'm not that far away. I'd drive there in a minute. I would. If you could get me a security pass, I'd come up there. I would hold your water the whole day. I'll tell you what.
We go in, we do a show, and we tell them the truth.
Well, I think it would be awesome. I will say, too, that I didn't know that you were teaching at SIU, or as it's commonly called, for those of us who grew up in Illinois, SUI, studying under the influence.
Now, that wasn't me.
Okay, well, you know exactly what I mean, though.
At least not that particular time it wasn't me.
Carbondale's reputation. when were you there?
Well, I taught there from 1975 through the end of 78.
That's funny. You could have been teaching some high school chums of mine. It's very odd.
Well, you know, I made a mistake in the last hour, and I want to correct it real quick. It wasn't Bartholomew de las Casas that wrote The Hope of Israel and talked to Oliver Cromwell. That was really Manasseh ben Israel in 1655 who did that. It was... I have Bartholomew de las Casas on the brain because he had the same experience I did when he followed Christopher Columbus into the Americas and did become the hero of the Indian tribes. But the thing that he sent back to his colleagues in Western Europe was that he was constantly bombarded with people who were talking about the second coming of their deity, and also they kept looking for marks in his hands and his feet. Now, that same experience happened to me. I was one of the very first people to stand in Tiwanaku in 1969, early in the spring of 69, and I had an interesting experience standing there right at the door to the sun. right in front of the Tichiwitacocha door. And the Indians came up to me and kept, I thought they were trying to shake my hand. And so I was grabbing their hand, and they didn't want to shake my hand. They wanted to take off my shoes, and they wanted to look at my hands. They wanted to know if I had any marks in my hands and my feet, and which I found, after thinking about it for a little while, it dawned on me what they were talking about. This Tichiwitacocha figure carved on the door to the sun was really the what they termed the great white god, creator of all the world, who taught them their faith and taught them their agriculture. And if you know anything about Tiwanaku, Tiwanaku is one of the most marvelously constructed agricultural sites in the world, designed to where the irrigation systems keep the crops from freezing. It's a mastermind. We couldn't have done better at an agricultural college in our day in constructing these agricultural sites. But
well, that is cool, and yet it, I want to make sure that, because I know at some point I'm going to have to go to the phones and everyone else is going to monopolize your time, so I want to know then, when do you think, or when do we suppose, these caves first began to be used for safety deposit boxes?
Well, the timing on them, we're really doing a historical profiling job when we do this. It is our estimation, because of the dating of the artifacts, the coinage, and also the busts of these, and the little hats the sailors wear, the Mauritanian sailors wore. First of all, we have to understand what a Mauritanian sailor is. This is a sailor on the northern coast of Africa. He is black, and he has a very distinctive headgear, and it comes from a very specific moment in history. Really, what likely happened here, and we're not the judge and jury, we'll let the forensic historians do their little number on the artifacts that come out of this thing, but from what I can tell here, is we're talking about a refugee group who fled Jerusalem. These were Pharisees who had very strong ties to the Essene movement, because this cave also has some innuendo that it is a worship place for the Sons of Light. And if you know anything about the Sons of Light, that was obviously a term used by the Essenes.
And to tie that together, just so people get the connection, these are the folks from the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Exactly.
So, and we assume that they're Essenes, by the way. I mean, we have every reason to believe, but they also might even be a subgroup of that, which, you know, they're still mysterious.
Well, likely a subgroup of that, actually.
Yeah. So here you have, so now you have Essenian material there, too?
Yes. Actually, what this looks like to me is that if I were to do this like a criminal profiler would investigate a site, and that's really what we have to do, because we're not at the stage of judge and jury on these artifacts, but we are at the stage of being able to tell generally what the impressions are left with. What it looks like is that these were a group of either Pharisees or conservative Essenes, not conservative, but more liberal Essenes, I should say, who were very wealthy, who escaped Jerusalem when the onslaught of the Romans near 60 A.D. began to this Jewish wars.
Right.
And, by the way, there was no place for these Jews to run. I mean, we had some of the Jews flee at that moment in history down into southern Africa, and we have the Limba, which we ought to have a program on them. There's 15 million of them in 60 tribes in southern Africa that claim to be the descendants of the House of Israel from that time period. We ought to talk about that someday. But,
I'd like to.
But in essence, where would you go? You get on a boat, and you take where the sailors take you, where they had already been before. And these sailors were Phoenician vessel sailors. They had already been to the Americas. We have many different places where we see evidence of Phoenician vessels landing in the Americas, not the least of which was that Christopher Columbus followed one of their maps. Christopher Columbus had a map to discover the Americas. Wouldn't it be nice to have a map to discover something that important like the Americas? And they had already been here, mapped the coast, and mapped into the interior. And So what they basically did is they went to the northern coast of Africa, where, by the way, at that moment in history, Cambridge and those places along the northern coast of Africa were being used, much like in the movie Gladiator, as resort communities for elite Romans. Kind of like going to Palm Beach, you know, to get out of Rome and enjoy yourself in the sun. So they were very inviting to these fleeing Jewish refugees, but they could not stay there either because the Romans began the onslaught of the destruction and disbursement of the Jews in Jerusalem. Were going from the center out and were looking. They went first of all to Jerusalem, but obviously the impact of that dissension and bitterness was eventually going to catch up with the Jews in northern Africa, and they knew it, and they knew they had to get out of town. Where could they go? They could go almost no place except west. And when the Phoenician vessels, the owners of the Phoenician vessels said, well, we have a place that's absolutely safe, where you're not going to get your money taken, you're not going to have your gold disturbed, and where you can worship like you want, we'll take you to a place that's green, and you can plant your plants and live like the Garden of Eden, literally. They jumped at the chance, and it looks like to me that these were refugees from the Roman onslaught of the Jewish wars in the first century.
Yeah. So explain, though, how this sort of polyglot artifact community develops, because
if you went to Cambridge, obviously you still had an Egyptian connection, and that's how they obtained the gold coinage of Cleopatra II. Certainly the Mauritanian artifacts were from the northern coast of Africa, which places these Jews deliberately and specifically on the northern coast of Africa during that century, and also the fact that it talks about it being a worship place of the Sons of Light, and they having a bust of Christ on it deliberately pinpoints them back to Jerusalem, having connections both with the Essenes and with the origins of Christianity. So this conglomeration makes sense if you think of these people as being refugees from Jerusalem at the time of the death of Christ.
Actually, several decades afterward, right?
Well, several decades. We're talking about after 60 A.D.
Right.
The Jewish wars really didn't get momentum until 66 A.D. However, the persecution began almost immediately after the death of Christ with Caligula. Caligula basically put his image in the temple and caused an enormous problem.
Right.
You don't go put your own image in somebody else's temple and think that it's going to set well, especially with the Jews. It didn't set well with them, and it wouldn't set well with anybody.
This is interesting to note, then, that this group comes over as, you know, any refugee community then might do, on the run, looking for a place to go. But why end up in southern Illinois? It not, you know, the party school reputation of southern Illinois notwithstanding, why there, of all places?
Are you ready to open up Pandora's box, my friend?
No. I'll tell you what, we'll leave the latch on it for just a moment, then, and I'll come back, because I think that's key. We'll find out what Glenn has in the box. Why is it that of all the places that they should end up, why not Miami? Why not Hispaniola? Why not up on the northern coast? Why not someplace easy to get to? Why there? Why upstream? We'll find out next on Coast to Coast AM, in for Art Bell. My name's Ian Punnett. Here are these affluent Jews of the first century Common Era, and the persecution has begun. Nero and other emperors have made it their goal to rid the empire, or to at least to smash the Jewish community, and then later on the Christian persecutions begin as well. across the empire, just going to make life miserable. So they take off. They use Mauritanian sailors, stop in North African ports, and head to the New World where these sailors have already been before. And that's where we're getting up to the point that if they were looking for a place that looked kind of familiar, where they could call home, where they could be comfortable, why not stop, for example, at the mouth of the Mississippi? Why not in the Delta area there, which would have looked a little bit more like Alexandria? Why not somewhere down in Florida, where the weather was fairly agreeable? Why start making the trek up the middle of the country? Glenn?
Well, once again, we're going to do a profiling here and not a hard forensic history. But there was another time when the Jews were being hard-pressed in Jerusalem, and that was in 583 B.C. with Jeremiah. Jeremiah and Daniel and Ezekiel all prophesied that the Babylonians were going to conquer Jerusalem if they didn't repent. And obviously that did occur. And Jeremiah escaped with Zedekiah and others out actually literally through the floor. We're going to show that particular one on someday on my show, and we'll do it with you too. But he got out of town, and the first place where Jeremiah would have gone to take the Ark of the Covenant was someplace where there was another temple that was exactly a replica of the Temple of Solomon, which was being conquered by the Babylonians, and that was basically in the city of Akhenaten down in southern Egypt or in Ethiopia, where he knew darn well that there had once been a temple. And he took the Ark of the Covenant there, which has been rumored both in the Bible and by legends and tales and historical events. And the Coptic Christians still tell you an entire story in their scriptures.
That it's still there.
That they will tell you it's still there. However, yep. It is not still there. Jeremiah, you cannot follow an artifact itself. An artifact does not have legs. An artifact does not have a mind. In order to follow the Ark of the Covenant, you have to follow the guy that had it in his possession. Where is the tomb of Jeremiah? Is that in Ethiopia?
No, I don't know, actually.
It is not in Ethiopia. Is it in Jerusalem? No, it is not in Jerusalem. Strangely enough, the Ark of the Jeremiah's tomb, the only place that's reported that Jeremiah had a tomb, was in Ireland. I know that sounds bizarre to everybody, but I can't help that. Jeremiah took Zedekiah and company to Ireland, and that's why Jesus' ancestors had such a British connection. By the time Jeremiah was on the scene, Brutus had already escaped the Trojan Wars, and he had a dream, as you recall, that he would go through the gates of Hercules. Diana, the goddess Diana, has told him to go through the gates of Hercules and go to the safest place in the world. And the Roman records, there's many places in Roman records which suggest that by the time of the birth of Christ, that the traffic between Britannia and Jerusalem had been well trafficked. And the reason why they say that is because of all of the people who had fled earlier conquests from Jerusalem had gone and been refugees in England. However, Jeremiah, interestingly enough, there are some manuscripts that have survived in our day, and I don't know whether they're true or not, but we certainly want to investigate them, that suggest that he had a vision on the way just before he arrived in Ireland. He said that most of the armada was to go to the right, and that he was to go to the left. Now, to the right, as you're going up the northern coast of Europe, is the British Isles. To the left is ocean. That's exactly where it is. And he was the one that had the Ark of the Covenant in his possession. Now, if you remember, Moses had a vision of where the Ark of the Covenant would be. It would be placed at the feet of Mount Nebo, at the crossroads of the Red, White, and Blue River, and would be in the Valley of the Blue Shroud. Now, that particular combination of geographical configurations does not exist in Jerusalem or the Middle East, and it certainly doesn't exist in England. There's only one place which today still has those configurations, and that was up the Mississippi to the place where there's an Indian tribe who call themselves the Ark Bearers. They call and bearer in their native language is Kansaw, or the Arkansas Indians who currently reside in Missouri today. It is my contention that it is possible.
Stop right there. That just kills me. I've never heard that. That totally kills me.
I can give you 10 websites that will tell you the same thing.
I bet you can. I'm. You'll just understand that that stupefies me, that that's where that comes from. Arkansas. Ark.
Well, it's kind of obvious that, I mean, is it that simple? I don't know. I don't know, Ian, whether that's true or whether that's false. I know one thing, that those legends do exist and that those manuscripts exist and that that history does exist. Now, whether that is really the truth or not, I don't know. The jury is still out on that one. We don't know. But the fact remains is that if you are profiling history, what you do is you listen to what is being said in textual form, in legend form, and in tales. And that is, and in fact, those both textually and in legends and tales, that tale does exist. And the antecedent of that is that you go to the Arkansas Indians today, they will tell you in their ancestry that they took something of tremendous, precious value and buried it in their history. And now, I don't know whether it's true or not, but I'm going to tell you it's extremely curious.
Yeah. Especially because of the word ark. Now, is there any origin in the Kansaw language for the word ark other than our understanding of ark from the Hebrew?
None that I know of.
Okay. Because that would, you know, if ark also happens to be the word for, you know, bottle or, yeah, jug, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, that would change a lot because then they would say, well, you know, heck. But if there is no other word and appears to be some sort of transliteration from the Hebrew into their language and they add on to that ark bearer, ark Kansaw, I don't know. It gives you chills. All right.
I don't know. You know, and I are sitting here with a hair standing up on the back of our neck.
I am.
And the only thing we can testify that is true is that the legends and the text do exist.
Well, and then where does that logically lead us? That in those caves in southern Illinois might be the Ark of the Covenant? I mean, we'll find out when we come back. The news next, but boy, talking about a headline, we'll ask Glenn Kimball what he expects to find when they begin the excavation in mid-August. We'll find out more details on that coming up on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett.
Coast AM with Ian Punnett on the Premier Radio Networks. Now, here's Ian.
Glenn Kimball is leading an expedition into the earth in mid-August, having located through ultrasound technology caves where previously reported treasures from the old world had been found in southern Illinois. And what is going to be found in these new caves, one can only speculate about, and that's just what we're doing with Glenn. Because as crazy as it just might sound, there is at least some indigenous record in the United States and a carryover remark or two that exists from the old world that the Ark of the Covenant just might have made it to the United States, just might have made it all the way up the Mississippi. Glenn, if you are a betting man, What would you put the odds at that you're going to find something like the Ark of the Covenant?
Well, we're definitely not going to find the Ark of the Covenant. Can I tell you why?
Okay, why?
The Ark of the Covenant, remember, is supposed to be buried at the feet of Mount Nebo at the crossroads of the Red, White, and Blue River in the Valley of the Blue Shroud. That place still exists, and that's in northern Arkansas in the National Forest there. It's still called Mount Nebo, by the way. And there's a whole bunch of towns around it called the very Jewish names, which is very interesting. If, in fact, the Ark of the Covenant survived and came to the Americas, that's where it would likely be found, not a couple hundred miles north up the Mississippi River. But I got to tell you something, that there's other circumstantial evidence here I want to talk to you about. I called the University of Illinois at Urbana and talked to their head archaeologist, the head of the department, and I don't want to embarrass the gentleman because he's a fine man. But I asked him, I said, for heaven's sake, you know, there are probably 3,000 or 4,000 known mounds, sacred mounds, including Monk's Mound, which is probably the largest pyramid in the Northern Hemisphere, if you look at it, there in Illinois. And people say, pyramid? Illinois? What's it doing in Illinois? You know, this was a sacred site. This was a holy place all the way up the Mississippi. These burial mounds aren't located in Arizona.
No.
They're not located in New Hampshire.
No.
They're located in the Mississippi Valley, and they were sacred sites for worship, much like they were used almost like conventions where Indian tribes would come thousands of miles to do their worshiping in this particular area. Why they would do that and build their holy sites and bury their dead there and do their worshiping there is got to have some antecedent in their history. I don't know what that antecedent is. I suspect that we will find someday that there's something very sacred and very ancient in the Mississippi Valley. And we've already found a bunch of it, and I don't want to give away all my little whiz-bang gizmos that we're looking up. But there are a number of other kinds of finds there in the Mississippi Valley which make this kind of a find not a unique proposition. You know, if, like I said at the beginning of the show, if this were a unique story, if this came out of the blue and there were no other tales, the presumption in my head would be that this is probably a lie. But the fact that it is one of many tales like this in this region, then the presumption turns, the pendulum turns, and we must now confront it as a possible reality.
But then, first of all, I get us back up. Why didn't it make bigger news? Why don't we regularly see photos of Cleopatra II coins in our history books if they were found and there was a photographic record of them in Illinois? How come we don't have pictures in history books? How come we don't have even just a more common discussion than this program on the original find in those caves?
I ask a similar question. Why don't we have Christopher Columbus's diary open to the world, which says that the Indians treated him like the second coming of the Messiah, where they looked in his hands and his feet and thought he was Jesus coming back? You know, why aren't those things published? I'm not to blame. You're not to blame. But we live in a political and prejudiced reality where we have Carl Sagan said it best. He said, preposterous claims require enormous vindication. Unfortunately, that means that we are a society that cannot make quantum leaps. Why? Because the quantum leaps must have quantum leap vindication. And that's sad, because then we've really put ourselves in an iron box and require ourselves never to look beyond a certain imaginary boundary line for our own history. I'm going to tell you that we are an infant society. We don't know 1/100th of our history in the Americas. We don't know, and that's being extremely generous to our historians. I would like to tell you that I've been to the universities in the country. I've taught at universities in the country. And I feel much like Gunnar Thompson did when he was fired from a great university in Washington State. And I won't tell you which one it was. But he was fired for writing the book Lions in the New Land. Why? Because it's not because his research wasn't Pulitzer Prize-winning research about the discovery, ancient discovery of the Americas, and by the way, everyone ought to have a copy of that book, but because it fell out of the jurisdiction of the accepted norms in his department at the university level. We have a problem in our universities. These people are departmentalized. One department doesn't talk to another department, and they don't talk to departments in inter-school, on an inter-school level. I had a real struggle when I got my PhD. I was writing my dissertation, and the head of the department came to me and he said, "Glenn, you cannot write this dissertation." And I said, "Why? Isn't it a worthy topic?" And it really was a worthy topic.
What was the topic?
Well, I wrote a paper on skin potentiometry as the secret to finding the secrets of autonomic signals for children. I know that, well, that's way off the topic, okay? But the answer of the department head was very interesting. He said, "I cannot let you write this dissertation because we don't know anything about what you're talking about." And I said, "What are you talking about? I came to school to learn and to learn how to learn. And just because I'm interested in skin potentiometry and the research that was done in 1936, and at the quantum leap of how that'll advance society," and he said, "And by the way, that particular discipline has never been advanced since I left the university." He said, "We just can't do it because you must do what we know, period. And if you exceed that box, we will not share your dissertation." There went 2,000 hours of dissertation up in smoke. Up in smoke. Now, if they had that kind of problem with me, they certainly had that problem with anyone who's at a university who makes a quantum leap.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating story, and I'd love to hear more about that sometime. Perhaps when you get me that pass so I can sneak onto the site when you guys are doing the investigation.
You won't have to sneak on the site.
I want a hard
as an honored
hat.
Guest.
Well, you're kind to say that. I think it's way cool. So we'll pick up that thought, though, and with absolutely no apologies for that very interesting sidebar, a glimpse into Glenn Kimball. I will, however, endeavor to take us down into the cave next. And since we know what has been found in other caves, what could be waiting then in this one? We'll find out with the guy who's willing to speculate. Coming up next, Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM, in for Art Bell. My name's Ian Punnett. Well, I think the pursuit of the Ark of the Covenant in Arkansas would be an interesting television show as well. I hope that's something that you have a chance to do sometime. In the meantime,
that's going to be on the pilot of my new series, by the way.
Oh, you have a new series coming up?
Yes, I do, and I'm not allowed to tell you what channel it's on.
No, don't tease us like that.
It's a television series.
Well, I'm guessing. Is it going to be, this is something that's being produced by a company you can talk about, or just not the channel you can talk about?
Well, Prime Media is doing the production.
Good. They're doing a lot of interesting stuff, aren't they?
And Prime Media is huge.
Yeah. Yeah, they sure are. That's good. So you got some good money behind you. Now, is it like a buddy cop show where you're the funny one, or is it like a... No, I'm teasing.
I would probably be best doing that. You know that. And I'm going to invite you as my first guest.
I'd love to. I want to be the celebrity bad guy.
You want to be the celebrity bad guy?
Yeah, I do. I do want to be. I think it'd be fun, like in a Barnaby Jones episode. You know, I want to be the special guest who committed the horrible crime.
Well, it's going to be called History Exposed. At least that's the pending title right now. So
interesting. When is it due for release?
Spring, hopefully, will be the three pilot series. Obviously, I think the Nielsens will go right through the roof. And when that happens, we'll get a contract for 26 shows a year. hour-long program. So, and you know if that happens, you and I will do some things together.
Well, that'd be fun. I will say this, though, too, that if you ever do get your own private eye show, I'll be your Bradford Dillman any day of the week.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to tell you one thing in reverence to I'd like to kiss his ring, and that's Art Bell.
Yes.
Art, if you are listening, I owe you everything. I know that you and I have not always seen eye to eye, but I'll promise you one thing. My undying gratitude will perpetually exist, and I will pay you back in kind and a favor of your choice at some moment. You want the keys to my car, call, ask. I'll drive it out and hitchhike home.
That's where I think a lot of people feel about what the show's been able to do for their research. So it's not surprising to hear you say that, but it's always nice to actually hear somebody take the moment to do it. So you've got this excavation, you've got a film crew, you've got everybody there ready to shoot coming up in mid-August, and you could be making some world news with a discovery. What do you think is in those holes, in these 30-foot vertical caves?
The surface ground covering the cave is 30 feet deep before you reach the cave, okay? So we're going to have to drill a hole 30 feet down and support it with concrete, because eventually what Wayne has planned is to open this up as a museum site, obviously. And certainly the artifacts will belong to the state. So what we're talking about are limestone caves. And the thing that's interesting is that if you know anything about limestone caves are carved out by the movement of water. And these caves have vertical metal objects in them, which no metal object is standing vertical after having been dragged through the water for a long distance. There's no such thing as a vertical metal object in a limestone cave unless there has been intervention or intrusion from the surface in some way, shape, or form.
Now, in this case, too, I mean, stop me if I'm wrong, limestone caves are formed by, like, groundwater seeping through and eroding the limestone, and so that the limestone ends up somewhere downstream somewhere in the water supply elsewhere. It kind of gets washed away.
Right.
So, but if it's a cavern underneath the ground, why not go in through the entrance that somebody else would have availed themselves of, you know, 2,000
years ago? Major political problem.
Okay.
Okay. Plus the fact, you know, we have another problem that we need to talk about that's most important. It even dates back to the time of the discovery of Tutankhamun's cave. We are terrified to death that if, in fact, these vertical metal objects are what we think they are, and that is there will be a gold statue standing vertically in these things, that over 2,000 years, that cyanide may have filled the air around these gold statues, and that's probably what killed those who... The King Tut's curse that killed those who first entered King Tut's tomb is they were killed by cyanide poisoning. So we're petrified, not of a curse on this cave, but from the possibility that there is a major deposit of cyanide in this cavern. So one of the things that will be done the very first few days will be huge fans will come in and blow out this cave, blow out the oxygen. So if we go and we actually go into the cave, I'm going to recommend that both of us use oxygen, artificial oxygen, just in case, and rubber gloves, just in case. Because, you know, your wife will kill me if I kill you.
Yeah, that's right. She will not be happy. Now, what's the reason that, is the oxidation from the limestone or from the metal, or what's the,
Wayne's,
what would be the...
Wayne's more versed on that than I am, okay. but all gold... Part of the big leaching vats that they have in Winnemucca, Nevada, et cetera, or in where major open pit mines are located, they use cyanide to leach through the gold, and the gold actually is dissolved by the cyanide, and they actually drain out the cyanide off the bottom and convert it back into gold. Well, apparently gold is very compatible with cyanide, and maybe in many cases is found in cyanide, and perhaps maybe even was smelted originally with cyanide techniques, in which case there's some intrinsic or latent cyanide in the gold itself. when it was originally mined. And after you set an object there for 2,000 years in the stagnant air, who knows what might happen. So this is a precaution. We're not positive that this effect will happen, but we're presuming that that's probably one of the problems with the opening of Tutankhamun's cave, was that these people died mysteriously of cyanide poisoning.
Okay.
Which is not strange at all. That's not mystical and not a curse. And by the way, it's very tough to detect unless you have a cyanide detection kit and take blood samples, which they did not have at the time of Tutankhamun's opening of his cave. So
okay, so, but you teased us there with the mention of the huge political problem that would keep you from going in the same entrance that they would have had to have used in order to erect these giant gold statues in this cave.
Well, the gentleman who originally found the cave has been baiting us for a decade about whether or not he would allow us in. And I'm tired of it, and so is Wayne and everybody else, and that's why we did the electromagnetic survey of the ground to see if there might not be other caverns available with other artifacts in them. That's exactly why we did it that way, rather than trying to go through the original cave site. The original cave site may in fact still have some of the artifacts there. I doubt it very seriously. Knowing the individuals involved, I doubt very seriously that there's anything left there. Most of it is in private. In fact, I can nearly assure you that most of it is in the hands of private collections. At least that's where we got our photographs, was from private collections that had the original artifacts. That's how they used to pay for the excavation. And I am nearly certain that most of the gold was smelted and moved to Switzerland anyway. These were not people who had the interest of the world at heart. They had their own pocketbook at heart. And I don't mean to insult people, but you know, that really is the rape of humanity when the people do those kind of things. And certainly neither you nor I nor Wayne May would ever do anything like that. We're not that kind of people. To be honest with you, there's more money in the film rights than the gold anyway. So,
no. Well, there is in the modern media.
Which,
in all fairness, wouldn't have been available to them as an option probably the first time they went in. But glad we're doing it this way. And I agree with you. This is world news. Now, I still want to get to some more specifics. We know that there are giant metal objects. The indication is that these are in these limestone caves. But of what origin do we expect them to be? I'll ask Glenn about that next. Are we talking about Egyptian idols? Gold from fashioned into what? Crosses? I don't know yet. I'm curious. We'll find out more. We'll go underground with Glenn Kimball before the excavation begins next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. To cases with Glenn Kimball, and then we'll give you the phone numbers coming up at the top of the hour, and we'll get you all in on the conversation as well. Glenn Kimball has made a career of looking for documents that others might have missed, or would summarily dismiss. Glenn's work in the past on this show has included some fascinating topics, some of which have been some of my favorite shows that I've had a chance to do on Coast to Coast AM, and this is no different. Glenn, as we're talking about these, the thought here that this Jewish group that is fleeing the emperor's persecution of religions outside of the official state religion of the empire at the time, and then they hook up with some Mauritanian sailors, they touch in northern Africa, they head to the New World, they bring with them what they have, things of value, things worth trading, things that, but would they have brought anywhere near the kind of riches that were found in these caves reportedly already, or that you suspect might be in these new caves which you're going to be excavating coming up in August?
Well, we have to think of the caves not as a bank where they buried their treasure like pirates and then left. That's not what happened here. There's evidence that these people actually worshipped at these sites for 400 or 500 years, and that these became sacred sites for these people. So the kinds of things that we might find in these locations might be some domestic things, for one thing. We're hoping, I'm hoping with bated breath that we find a document of any sort, any shape, any size, any language. It doesn't matter to me. You can keep all the gold, and you can keep all the coins and everything else. If they have a manuscript in this cave, I'm going to get on one knee and thank the Lord that we found something.
Okay.
You know?
Well, yet the issue then of these giant statuary images that you think might be down there, these big, big enough to show up on these
big
sonar,
enough
right?
To where we're talking way more than a foot, probably in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 feet in height. We're talking about a worship site here, which very well, these vertical statues very well might have been objects of veneration of some sort.
Well, I guess that's the question, though, is it would not be part of the Judaic tradition to have graven image. Would these have been from the Egyptians?
Well, you know, a vertical metal object could have been a nine candelabra. You know, who knows? We're not talking about having a golden calf in these things. You know, it could have been it could have been a part of a worship altar of some sort.
Okay, and I think what you're referring to the eight candles that you.
Yes, okay. Of course.
That's fine. No, I was just curious.
My brain's gone dead at this.
No, that's fine. I just want to make sure I understand. Well, because your information is voluminous. Now, so we think then that whatever this is down there, it's showing up as metal in the caves, and that is striking. Now, you don't think this could be some mineral deposit, some natural ore deposit in these caves?
From the survey that we got, these metal detecting devices, these electromagnetic metal detecting devices, are specifically designed to detect heavy metals. You know, it could be iron, vertical iron deposits of some sort. I don't think so. They're used primarily in the mineral industry to detect gold and silver deposits, veins of gold and silver. Now, that does not mean necessarily that that's exactly what they are, but a vein of gold would be in an irregular position in underground. These are totally vertical. And that's what is so strange and so hopeful about this particular find, is that we're looking at a heavy metal object. And when I mean heavy metal, I mean metals that are composed of heavy atoms, vertically in a vertical position, which is a dead giveaway that we're talking about an intrusively placed object of some sort. Now, you know, maybe a spacecraft fell out of the sky and buried itself 30 feet in the earth and we're detecting that. I don't know. We don't know. But the fact that there has already been an antecedent or a cooperative kind of a discovery event in that very location we're presuming that we're going to find like kind of artifacts in this particular cave. I'm presuming that there will be stone busts, hopefully with some inscriptions on them, telling us more about the nature of the worship that went on in this location. I'm hoping, beyond hope, that whatever stone busts there are, or stone writings there are, will vindicate my presumption that these caves were used as worship sites like the Sons of Light did in Qumran.
Mm-hmm.
If that is the case...
Now that's interesting tie-in, because certainly the caves were well used around Qumran, ergo the Dead Sea Scrolls that we
exactly.
have to this day. Right, that's an interesting connection there.
Caves are not unusual to the Essenes, you know?
No, is there any other evidence or any other testimony in the history? Because, I mean, this isn't that long ago that we're talking about. If you're saying up to the 5th century, perhaps this worship was still going on in this area, these sacred sites. Is there any other testimony that said that there were people other than Native Americans that were living in this area? Are there Native American traditions that isolate... they talk about a particular tribe of people not being like one of their own, or something like that?
Well, there are. There are traditions where Native American Indians interfaced with other cultures who were travelers, voyagers through their territories. But to be very honest with you, that is really the responsibility of the forensic historians to accumulate that kind of jury evidence. We are in such the beginning stages of something here, Ian. Most of the guests on Art Bell come with the conclusions. I'm really not coming with a conclusion tonight, except to say that we have profiled this. The profiling looks like we've got Jewish artifacts that traffic through the northern shores of Africa, through the Mauritanian civilizations, and came up the Mississippi to escape persecution and to worship. I beyond that, I don't know if I could really speculate accurately as what might have happened. Certainly, I don't know enough about the Native American Indian tribes in the area, because that's one thing I did not do, was talk to any of the Native American Indians
right.
in Southern Illinois when I was teaching at the university. Now, that's very odd for me, because when I lived in Bolivia, Chile, Peru, Mexico, and everywhere else I've gone, I've always befriended the medicine men. I know the heirs of the Inca throne in Peru. I know Camarino in Oaxaca. I know lots of people in South America. I befriended the medicine people. But in California, I befriended the leaders of the Laguna Nation, and I followed Carlos Castaneda's into Oaxaca, and befriended some of the Yaqui Indian medicine people, which was a terrifying experience. But but I did not befriend anybody in the Mississippi Valley. I just didn't know where they were or how to contact them, and I didn't make contact. So I really don't know the traditions. These are all things that will be post hoc kinds of events that will have to be done after the site's been opened.
Okay. And that's just where I want to go next. Glenn Kimball, I'll let people start yakking with us coming up at the top of the hour. We'll give out the phone numbers. But next, I want to get to the excavation. What's the plan? How's it going to look? And just hang on a second. We'll get to that in just a moment. In your imagination, as you see this laid out and as you've talked about with the planners, how long is it going to take? Who's going to be the first one down? How are you going to get there? We'll go over all of this in just a moment for the big date coming up in mid-August. Glenn Kimball going underground, trying to get to the bottom, as it were, of these ultrasound images showing sites underground that could be sacred from a civilization that the record of history in this country rarely implicates arrived here and participated in. On Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Punnett. talking with Glenn Kimball about the TV show and excavation site, which is going to be slated coming up for August. So you're going to have the TV crew there when you're going to be breaking ground. You're going to have how many people will it take to do an excavation like this? Tell us more about the plans.
Well, there's really going to be a German film crew who are part of the original investors, and they'll be taking some film. This project really belongs to the Ancient American Magazine. You can find the Ancient American Magazine at www.ancientamerican.com. And Wayne has planned, it doesn't take very long to punch through a 30-foot hole with the kinds of excavation equipment we have coming in. The problem comes in making sure that before people get down into that cavern, that we completely replace the air content in the cave, and that also that there is some moorings or footings poured around the entrance of this cave. We're not going to drill a 44-inch hole and expect everyone to be dropped down through on ropes. That's not going to happen, because if it is, I'm not going down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I won't make it, because I'm a 45, not a 44, you know? And it won't. We won't make it through. They're planning to punch a big enough hole through a 30-foot hole. 30 feet's nothing these days. Any kind of a mining equipment, you can get a backhoe to dig 30 feet.
Okay, so we're going to have... But a big drill. You're going to drill a large hole, and will people be lowered down, or are you going to have some other way of getting in there?
Actually, there's going to be a hole drilled, but there's actually going to be a bigger hole than just a hole drilled. There's actually going to be a passageway cut in, and footings poured around the opening so that people can actually walk into it.
Okay, and so you're going to be not going straight down, but going down at an angle.
The initial hole will be straight down, and then there will be one on an angle that will go into an entrance like a doorway.
Okay.
Down a stepway into it as a doorway.
And can you tell me more about this German crew? I mean, it's cool, but why would Germany be here making some documentary about this?
Believe it or not, I don't know why the British come over and film American history and play it on the Discovery Channel. I don't understand that either. But a German investment group is part of the four groups that own the excavation actually for the site, and own the site, the film rights for the site, etc. So the German film crew will actually sell rights to us because they're one of the original investors that will be paying for the actual equipment and the security guards that will guard the cave after it's opened and those kinds of things. So, and I imagine that they will have their own brand of German Discovery Channel going on right in Germany on this particular site.
Will there have to be somebody there from the state of Illinois?
I'm hoping that the state of Illinois will take it credibly enough to have an entire team there. The state of, like I told you earlier in the program, I'd contacted the museum or the archaeological head of Champaign-Urbana, and I asked him the question when and this was just a couple of months ago, and I don't want to embarrass the man, but I said, "What's being done to preserve all of these sacred burial mounds along the coast, along the Mississippi?" And he says nothing. He says we plow them under with our tractors, and that was his comment. And I thought, this man must be nuts, or he's just being rude, or he's just trying to put me off. But literally, that has been the attitude. There have been thousands of these burial sites, these mound sites, that have literally been a backhoe will come in, or a plow will come in and level the site out for agricultural purposes. How many thousands of them have been that might have had precious artifacts, or probably did have precious artifacts in them, were just tilled under the ground? We know, for example, that it's not been unusual in that area all the way up into Wisconsin and Michigan for farmers to find swords and other kinds of artifacts in their fields because they plowed up sacred sites, archaeological sites. And in Illinois is no exception to that rule. We have become a very irreverent society. You go to South, you go to, let's just take another example. You go to China, and the largest pyramid in the world is located in China, and right in front of the pyramid are the Terracotta Warriors. And one would have to ask themselves, well, the Chinese communists probably have gone inside this pyramid to see what's inside. No, they haven't. They are terrified of going inside that pyramid. Nobody has been inside that pyramid. Not the Chinese communists, not anybody. We're the only country in the world that would dig a hole in there and say, hey, what's in here? You know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if we found something, we'd haul it out, melt it down, and send it to Switzerland. You know? We are the people who burn our books. We're the ones that burn everything outside the Bible. We are the most destructive society that has ever existed on this planet. And if something isn't done, we'll probably exhaust our resources, pollute the environment, and kill ourselves in the process.
Now, I know when you put your head down on your pillow at night, as you must do sometime, anyway, with all this energy you have, I'm sure there's times anyway where you must sleep. And when you're there sort of ruminating over the planning of this or thinking about the big day coming up, what is it that in your best hope you think you will find when you talk about looking for documents? What would be the best case scenario for Glenn Kimball?
I would hope that there would be a worship text from the Sons of Light located in this cave. I hope there is. It might explain many things from a very different perspective. Right now, you know, people approach me all the time and say, you know, do you believe strictly in the Bible? And if you don't, is there conflicts? Well, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls come conflict with the Bible. The Nakamati Library, the St. Catherine's collection, everything conflicts with everything else. And I'm not so much concerned with the conflicts. I'm looking for the similarities. The similarities are what tell us the tale in history. The differences are very, very human. You give people 100 years and they'll change any tale. It evolves over centuries. What I'm hoping that we will find is the origins of the both history and religion of the ancient America somewhere located in this cave, at least some hint of it, some discussion of it. That would give us an enormous... This would be more valuable than any gold that we could find. It would give us a place to start trying to reprofile American history. And it is my contention that history, if it is found in this cave, will vindicate the founding fathers who came here for religious freedom and came here with origins back to the Judeo-Christian heritage, that they will find that perhaps maybe the Judeo-Christian heritage was here before they came. Would that be wonderful?
Be absolutely fascinating. And a complete challenge to all that we know. And yet then the subtext to that question has to be, what happens if you open up the cave and all you get down and find in there is, Al Capone's comb? You know, or a picture of Geraldo Rivera, or what if you get all the way down there and nothing's there?
Well, certainly that is a distinct possibility. However, when we look at probabilities, looking at the survey, the electromagnetic survey, there is something odd down in this cave. It may not be the story we've told on the air. In fact, I can guarantee you that there'll be additions or deletions somewhere in this text. But it'll be fascinating either way.
Well, and so will the next hour ahead with Glenn Kimball, as I'm sure many of you have been waiting for your chance to jump in on the phones. We'll give you all the numbers you need to know for you to join the conversation next on Coast to Coast AM, in for Art Bell. My name's Ian Punnett. Without your love. A couple hours ago, and we said that right up front, that this is, as I use the metaphor of the O'Hare International Terminal, that there's plenty of traffic in that period. First time caller line, Fred is in New York on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. Fred?
Hi, that was fast. Thanks. I want to know, does the person there, your guest there, does he talks about the, know of the African connection, any, for instance, the Mali or the Nubians who they said that, you know, they saw African-type sculptures with helmets and armor, that type of thing. I think it was one of the civilizations called the Olmecs, I think. Is there any connection, you know, to that? Because it's interesting, you had a guest before who talked about lost cities of African Arabia, and I was wondering maybe in the future show you can go into the, you know, those, the advanced civilizations in Africa other than, you know, Egypt and, you know, civilizations that still continue today.
Great question. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, actually, the Olmecas probably were black, and I had one of the most precious Olmecan artifacts. When the law was passed in the United States that you should not possess any Mexican artifacts, I contributed mine to a university museum. But the Olmeca, the black influence in this country was huge, especially during the Olmeca era of time. And the Olmeca stones down in Central America are without question evidence of the black migrations into this country long before slavery came to here. Came to the Americas. It's interesting to note that there were 2 million slaves that came to the continental United States. There were about 5 million slaves that went to the Caribbean, but there were 8 million slaves that went to Brazil. And believe it or not, most of those were slaughtered or killed in the mines in Brazil. And it was a tragedy of such immense proportions. It almost rivals the slaughter of the 50 million Native American Indians that were in the Amazon jungle at the time when Pizarro landed. Yeah. There's not evidence that Pizarro killed them, but there's some suggestion that they died of diseases that were European-born and brought to this country. But the evidence of their civilization still is in the Amazon jungle. Where I lived, where I worked, where I've been, where I can tell you hands-on experience with this one because I was there. But yes, the black... We ought to do a show sometime on the Lemba, which...
Yeah, that was really interesting when you mentioned that earlier.
The Lemba, we shouldn't talk about American Judaic history. We should talk about black Judaic history. There's 15 million Lemba in southern Africa, and 60 tribes that belong to the Lemba movement that still practice circumcision, that still have the commandments,
without
still
a doubt.
Talk about the Messiah. They still have the apostolos, the 12 apostolos that travel around, and they claim openly that they are descendants of the house of Israel.
You know, even more than that, and I think it is a great topic suggestion, there is plenty of evidence, even in the Bible, to make a connection that kind of goes under the radar because it doesn't fit into the overall narrative. But if you actually look closely, I think there's several points where there is a big emphasis put on the Ethiopian approval, and we'll just get into that at some other time. But it's an indication that there was a great respect for the Ethiopian culture. And
without any doubt.
Yeah. We'll come back. Everybody's lining up. I don't have an open line right now, but I'll try and get one for you. For Glenn Kimball, who is... a perennial favorite here on Coast to Coast AM. You can link up to him through the artbell.com website and look forward to the new shows coming up. Glenn's taping another episode, a program that will probably run in Europe before it runs here, August 15th, as they go down into a cave looking for ancient artifacts on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Where do we go? We got a bunch of people from Memphis, which is not surprising considering the topic and where we are in the country. I don't know, actually, guys in the studio, where did I leave off? I left off first. Let's go wild card line. Kenneth in Springfield on Coast to Coast AM. Kenneth?
Yes, Glenn and Ian, great show tonight. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I guess we are looking at the error of enlightenment.
The error of enlightenment. Yes.
I wanted to bring up some present phenomena that may link to the evidence of what you're looking for. You mentioned the bluegrass, and it got me thinking about the foals that were dying there from the cyanide poisoning. Do you think that could link to something you're looking for in that area?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. I haven't done any of the surface studies or been involved in the surface studies, so I don't really know.
I thought that had more to do with the fruit that was falling into the ground, seeping into the ground.
Either the fruit or they never really determined what it was from. It kind of caught me funny when you mentioned the cyanide in the cavern, that maybe that was escaping out.
Well, this is our fear. And I don't believe that there's cyanide escaping 30 feet of surface ground. I think our fear is that we're just trying to be very cautious, because there were some major deaths when they opened Tutankhamun's tomb, and the only reason why there were deaths associated with that and not opening other kinds of tombs, one of the variables obviously was the quantity of gold that was found in Tutankhamun's tomb. And we are half tongue-in-cheek hopeful. Wayne, in his own words, says that this will rival a Tutankhamun discovery with regard to precious metal discoveries here. That is his thought. If Wayne is right, you watch out, man. This will be the discovery of the century.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Jim, Corvallis, Oregon, on Coast to Coast AM. Jim?
Hi, Ian. Hi, Glenn. Wonderful topic and discussion. I just thought I'd pitch in a bit of information. I took a multicultural history class and read a book called Crossing the Danger Waters by Deirdre Delane, and basically it talked about a African king who sent an expedition across the Great Ocean. They never came back, and maybe that was the start of the Olmecs visiting there. Now, there's pictures of Mesoamerican paintings that show black people, red people, and white people all working together. And it's certainly consistent with what we've been talking about here. Now, when you get into this cave, be on the lookout for ancient Greek writings, Cyrillic writings, and Coptic. That would be very indicative of the time and the period. These people obviously were multilingual. And it would be really wonderful if you could find those things.
Any writings whatsoever. Yeah. I don't care what language it'll be in.
If
we find cuneiform, if we find Coptic or cuneiform in this cave, I'll jump up and down. If we find anything in Reformed Egyptian or any kind of a language whatsoever, it won't make any difference. I guarantee you we will find a translator, and it won't be me, though I love to dabble at that myself. We will get the best translator in the world to take a look at a text.
If it were written in Ubby Wubby.
Yep. In Pig Latin.
You'll take any language at all.
It won't make no difference.
That'll be very interesting. And the date again is coming up August 15th. The armed guards will be ready to go when they pop the top on this cave. And we'll be bringing you regular updates coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This mentioned for tomorrow's show, though, an update that many of you asked for before on Bigfoot expeditions that brought us the plaster cast and some of the hair fiber evidence. We'll get to that. We'll find out also more about some of the conclusions coming out of the lab in other respects to the big hunt, the Bigfoot hunt going on. That's tomorrow on Coast to Coast AM. I'll be in for Art then. And then it looks like Art coming back next week. Cross your fingers. And we've got another half hour yet, at least, to go with Glenn Kimball. We'll get to your questions and comments about this excavation on the horizon on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett.
Suggest that King Ophir was really just a town of Ophir, but there really was a King Ophir. That group, it still exists and is documented in the petroglyphs in Peru. They were there picking up gold out of the streams at that particular moment in history, the 6th century BC, and bringing it over to build temples with and to ordain Egyptian
holy places as well. So, you know, when we talk about a global community, we're going to have to rethink our anthropology right. for the entire globe.
As a previous guest said, you know, the oceans weren't barriers, they were highways. Let's go west of the Rockies. Jack is in Phoenix, Arizona on Coast to Coast AM. Jack?
Well, you just stole a little bit of my thunder, but not too much. I got a couple of comments, a joke, and a question.
Okay, well, in whatever order, go ahead.
Okay, the first joke is I'm originally from Illinois, and there's a city in Illinois outside of Chicago called Mount Prospect, where there's no mount.
You'll say Mount Prospect. You have to say Prospect. Yes, I know very well the Mount Prospect without a mount. You're right.
Well, I thought that was interesting. But also, I was just watching television the other day, and there was a woman that, by herself, sailed around the world in 80 days. I see no reason why, with the sailing technology, which really hasn't grossly changed in thousands of years, why it wouldn't be imminently possible.
Well, may I interject a comment here? I believe the Dark Ages, beginning with the 11th century through the 15th century, we actually retrogressed in our sailing engineering. The vessel, you know, you could put the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria all inside QV2, you know. But the vessels prior to that, coming out of India, were huge ocean vessels. And why in the world Columbus sailed on these little tiny vessels and took three of them across the ocean talks more about the economic conditions in Spain at the time than it did about the technology of sailing the oceans via the vessels. So prior to the Dark Ages, sailing technology actually was a religion, much like Pythagoras' theorem. By the time of Christ, the great secret was that you could travel 40 times farther in a day on a boat than you could by camel. And by the time of Diocletian in the 3rd century, Diocletian institutionalized ocean traffic by saying that if you took merchant goods overland for 300 miles, you doubled the cost of those goods. He said, however, if you take them by sea, it will cost you one-third the cost, and you can go 10 times as far. And so ocean traffic really has become the secret or the sacred combination of in history.
Yeah. And it should be pointed out here, too, that although this will sound kind of cold, that the idea of the single sailor getting in a boat, traveling a long distance, such as the woman just recently did, just to prove the point, would have been even more likely in those bathtub-like boats. Simple boats didn't require a ton of money. Wasn't, you know, the construction of these things was pretty rudimentary. But, and this was kind of the cold-hearted part, is that actually people at many other times in history would have had a lot less to live for. There would have been, there's evidence, just testimonial evidence, that because of persecutions, because of just the same reason we were talking about, where suddenly you got to take flight, you got to get out of there, politics change, that lots of times, especially with life expectancy to be, you know, 30 or 40 years, why not give it a try? I mean, there are times when it would seem in history that that type of exploration would not have been seemed suicidal. It would have been seemed the better of the two options, even if you never came back to see the rest of your family.
Certainly that was the way to become rich in those days, is that if you owned the ability to own a caravan or to own merchant traffic of any sort, that was the way to become wealthy.
Well, it was worth the gamble, is what I'm saying, because...
Well, there's some evidence, too, that we live in a day and age when the seas have more tempest to them than they did in history as well. So maybe the seas were calmer in a former period of time.
Hmm. Well, the phones are tossing about pretty well. We'll get back to more of those They're coming in on waves. We'll go east of the Rockies next for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Okay, coming up on the top of the hour, I think we have at least time for Harold, and then we've got another hour yet to go of open lines on Coast to Coast AM with our guest, Glenn Kimball. I say open lines, not meaning to imply we won't be talking about this, because we certainly will. Glenn will be with us for one more hour as we take your questions and comments on Coast to Coast AM. Harold in Pittsburgh for Glenn Kimball. Go ahead, Harold.
Yes, Ian, thank you for taking my call. Question to Glenn is, back at the time of the Ark of the Covenant, there were no Indians in the Arkansas, Illinois area. How does he deal with that situation? I'll hang up and listen to you on the radio.
Well, first of all, you have to say, what preposterous notion is that? I've never heard of such a thing. Certainly, we have evidence that there were Indian tribes in that area.
We're talking about two different eras, and Ark of the Covenant, I think, is what he meant to say. But even still, the period of the creation isn't really what we're talking about either. The period we're talking about is what's called the intertestamental period, of the first century in that era, or even before. There's all sorts of evidence to say that there were natives already here at that time. I mean, that's not even a... There's no doubt about that, is there, Glenn?
Well, no. And we always will get someone out there that will say, nope, they don't exist,
Right.
And there's very little you can say to these individuals they do exist. That's the only comeback. To think that there weren't Native American Indians in the Mississippi Valley, as back as far as the time of Jeremiah, is simply ludicrous. The mounds that were built along the Mississippi Valley date long before that period of time, and they were built by the Native Americans in this country. So to presume that there weren't Native Americans in the area of Arkansas by the time of Jeremiah is just...
Can't imagine. First time caller line, Becky in Long Beach for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Becky?
Yes, it's an absolutely fascinating show. I'm a first-time listener, too. Glenn, I know an earlier caller asked about Joseph Smith, but more specifically, I am finding it amazing and intense that what you're saying correlates with the Book of Mormon account of Lehi and his family escaping the destruction of his Jerusalem, coming to America. Have you studied these accounts, and what do you think of them? And they are intense, the implications.
Well, people write me all the time from all over the world thinking that I am the collector of Mormon history because I live in Salt Lake City, which is not the case, by the way. I had an email from Wilson and Blackett, who wrote the Holy Kingdom book, and they sent me evidence that of the actual physical existence of Laban, one of the characters in the Book of Mormon, who was the king. And by the way, that evidence not only talked about his existence, but about his death at the hands of another by sword, and that he lost a set of brass plates. And this was a record out of Jerusalem itself, stored in Cambridge University in England. Don't ask me, because I'm not the spokesman for a particular faith, and never will be. Please don't ask. The point of the matter is, if you find some very interesting parallels that with regard to Catholicism or with regard to Jewish history or Mormonism or whatever, I find that I am a great supporter of that. I think that's terrific. Have fun. Enjoy. And remember that God's in his heavens. That I will confess, and I am a Christian apologist. Pardon me. I won't apologize for that.
Well, it's a good way to start next hour, though, because I do think there are a lot of people out there that might have felt threatened by this information before we got started. And I think now they're going to have a much better idea of where Glenn Kimball is coming and or where we are going with this next. As we continue to talk about the caves, which are under excavation in just a matter of days, looking for artifacts which, if Glenn's suspicions are correct, could contain some ancient sacred candelabra, some perhaps some other gold artifacts from this site in southern Illinois. And we'll get more from you on this with Glenn on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett.
South of the border is eating beans.
I know.
Wearing sombreros. The truth of the matter is that the Peruvians eat very much like the Orientals with rice and fish.
Fish.
And very much a cuisine from the sea. And I have eaten the strangest things in the world in Peru and in Arica, Chile. I could tell you my food stories, but no one would go and visit those countries if I did.
But yes.
They're still moving.
That's true. But nonetheless, I think you're right that there. I did notice a very African flavor to or cuisine in terms of much of their foodstuffs there. I found anticuchos to be very interestingly correlated with things that I found in Africa too. Anticuchos are marinated beef heart on a shish kebab, which is a very African type of cuisine.
And a shish kebab goes all the way up to the Mughals and
exactly.
Those other things.
She knows her food.
Yeah.
So I was just, I never really heard of any archaeologists really discussing cuisine so much. And when
I try not to, because I'm way cuisined. I look in the mirror and I've been cuisined.
Over cuisined.
Cuisined. Cuisine the Soros.
Anyway,
yeah.
Thank you, Debbie. I appreciate that question. Interesting question. I've eaten Ethiopian a couple of times, and I thought it's one of the best restaurants I've ever eaten in. It's an Ethiopian restaurant.
Really?
Yeah. Which you don't, I mean, because of the famines and everything, you don't necessarily associate with cuisine, but it is just a marvelously robust diet, I thought. Anyway, we'll come back. We'll get a bunch more, and no shortage of callers. We'll go to Little Rock, Arkansas, and we'll talk with Brian, he not being far from the place that Glenn says. There's one tradition saying that might be where the Ark of the Covenant is. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Punnett. We'll go west to the Rockies in just a moment. First, let's go east to the Rockies where Brian is in Little Rock on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. Brian?
Hey, how's it going? Y'all doing all right?
Yeah, thanks for hanging on.
For hanging up?
I said thanks for
hanging
on.
Oh, no problem. I've got three questions, really. The first one, it all concerns the Mount Nebo thing.
In Arkansas?
Yes, because I'm about an hour's drive away from there. I've been camping there many nights, probably 20 or 30 times over my lifetime. It's a nice place.
Anything strange going up there?
Anything strange going on? No. It's real good scenery. Mount Nebo is a wonderful place. Lots of springs around the area and whatnot. But you said that you were maybe going to do some excavations around there or take a look around there?
I'll tell you one of the artifacts that I would not want to find myself personally would be the Ark of the Covenant.
Just because of Raiders of the Lost Ark?
No, it's more intense than that.
Yeah, it was said to topple armies and cause great destruction.
Yes.
So that pretty much knocks out all of my questions. I was going to ask you what you were going to do with it. And
you wanted to come with you, I think.
And that was my third question.
If you needed any
grunt work.
There's some things that people should not know. We were born in ignorance. We knew more before we got here. And that was intentional. Much of Western Christianity does something very different than Eastern religions. We believe that knowledge, that somehow that we are in a competition for knowledge, and that if we gain a certain amount of knowledge, that we win heaven as a prize. The Eastern religions are far more laissez-faire in that particular issue. they're more casual about the idea that sometimes ignorance is a blessing, and certainly in the case of the Ark of the Covenant, one of if I knew exactly where the Ark of the Covenant was today, I would never go there on purpose.
that'd be a tough temptation for me to pass up, though.
Well, I will pick up your ashes and spread them for the wind.
See, you are thinking it's going to be like Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with Glenn on that one.
Well, hey, Brian, let me ask you a question. Have you ever heard anything about that until you heard it on the air?
No. In all my trips there, I've never heard of that. Okay. The river, the red, white, and blue, the Blue Shoals Valley.
Okay.
I've never heard of that.
Well, it may change the way you look at it next time.
Possibly. Well, I've got some people that I've known that have gone there and have driven up the mountain and driven the National Forest Service roads there and have told me of some very bizarre experiences, and that's why I ask you if you had some.
Right.
And I don't know. You know, people are people, and they'll tell you what they want to tell you. But certainly that is one of the locations of the Seven Thunders Mountain, so... and that's a historical term. So,
well Brian, judging by the clicking on your phone, though, I have some bad news for you. I believe the FBI is tapping your phone, so you might want to look into it. You may have some mysterious experience going on after all. Let's go west to the Rockies. Daryl is in Everett, Washington, on Coast to Coast AM. Daryl,
how you doing tonight?
Doing all right. You're talking with Glenn Kimball.
Hey, Glenn. I'm originally from Louisiana, and I'm just curious if you ever got a chance to visit the Poverty Point site.
Yeah, I lived in New Orleans for a short period.
Tell me about the Poverty Point site. I don't think I know about that, Daryl.
It's a pretty vast cultural area. It takes up several acres, and they have a huge earthworks. I think it's about 200 yards long. It's a giant bird, and it's... what is it? It forms a huge octagon. There are several rows of hills around it, which form the huge octagon shape. And on the solstices, the sun would set on the summer solstice. It would set on one side of the wings, and on the winter, the other.
Cool. Well, I have a question for you. Yeah. Was that accidental?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
No, this is a pretty impressive place, and I do believe there is a website to it.
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the website is, but, you know, we find these things all the way up and down the Mississippi, but we never hear them in our travel brochures.
No.
We hear about swimming pools and gambling casinos and riverboats and cuisine, but we don't hear about the archaeology, which is intense up and down the Mississippi.
Yeah, this is a pretty good-sized place. I was blown away when I went there.
Very blown away.
Thanks, Daryl. Appreciate that. Let's get to Mike from Huron, Ohio, real quickly for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM, the first-time caller line. Mike?
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I have a question and a comment for Mr. Kimball. Have you ever studied the traditions of Glastonbury as far as the Celtic crosses throughout southern England with a picture of a boy and a grown man on a ship? And also, some people believe they have found the tomb of Jeremiah in the land of Hibernia, which means the land of the Hebrews. Ancient name for Ireland, by the name of Owen Fowle, and I'll hold to your comments.
My point exactly. I wish you'd just restate your point, because that's exactly correct. of course, the Celtic crosses, there's a great book written called Celtruid and Chaldee. Obviously, the Chaldee were the earliest above-ground Christianity in existence, long before Catholicism came on the scene. Christianity was an underground religion for at least a century because of the persecution of the Romans. We're going to have a talk someday, because the Romans were very schizophrenic in their treatment of Christians. By the time of the first century, just before Hadrian, right at the time of Titus, they actually... Well, I could get in this and we could digress for a month.
No time.
Just trust me that we could talk about... both the hatred and the love of the earliest Romans for Christianity, and the Celts were the ones who preserved the earliest part of Christianity.
But it suffices to say that, as they did in every other respect across the landscape, they permanently altered the topography of Christianity. I'm reading about that right now in one of the courses I'm taking in summer school. But that's just one of the reasons why I love having Glenn Kimball as a guest, because you just never quite know what's going to come up next when we do these phone calls, and we've got another half hour. Let's rack them up as we continue to explore what's under the ground in southern Illinois on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Have you ever stayed at the Larry Bird Hotel?
No.
Larry Bird owns at least one, I think probably a series of these motels.
I was teaching at Carbondale when he came through and played the Salukis.
Oh, right. He would have been, yeah. Well, that I think it's Indiana State. Was he? Who did he play
for? Yeah, Evansville.
Evansville. No. He was in Terre Haute. He was up in, when I was driving up to Chicago, I stayed at the Larry Bird Motel. And my wife and I were staying in the room. I couldn't sleep because they had pictures of Larry Bird all over all of the walls. And so as I'm lying there in bed, it was Larry Bird looking at me from every possible direction.
Oh, my God.
The whole motel is an homage to Larry Bird. Listen, I can't wait to get these last two callers on, not least of which because all the questions have been interesting, but also because I know that Glenn Kimball is going to be going into, you're going to probably be in this pre-production mode between now and August 15th. You've got a lot to do, but I appreciate all the extra time you've given us on the show. So we'll come back and we'll get our last segment of calls and questions for Glenn Kimball next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. West of the Rockies, Ziggy is in California on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. Ziggy?
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Great show. What I'd like to ask Glenn is, you mentioned Ethiopia earlier. I want to know, I have two questions. One, I want to know, do you know anything about Rastafarian history and how it's a link to Christianity? And my second question is, why wouldn't Jesus smoke marijuana since God created it?
Well, Ziggy, I'll answer. Glenn, do you want to handle the Rastafarian question? Do you know what he's talking about?
I think this is Ziggy Marley on the phone.
Yeah, well, I think he thinks he is, anyway.
Well, Ziggy Marley was participated in the translation of the Kibra Ganast, which is obviously in the African scriptures, Christian scriptures, which is kind of interesting. If you don't have a copy of those, Ian, you need to call me.
Oh, that's interesting. I'd like to, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, Rastafarian is not my forte, and it's really not an Ethiopian origin either.
No, and let me explain that real quickly because it sort of got jumbled up. What he's referring to is this supposed connection between the Rastafarian tradition, which is part import and part native religion in the Caribbean, and the Coptic Church of Ethiopia. And at one point, I believe a leader or considered a renegade leader of the Coptic Church had made this connection that there was this strong relationship. And I think later leaders of the church repudiated that.
Well, that's why I'm suggesting that he really needs a copy of the Kibra Ganast, because really that is the Rastafarian gospel.
Right.
So... If he wants to read all about it, it's on my website, by the way, listed there, and you can order a copy.
I looked into that at one point because just for that reason, a lot of people like Ziggy, I think, hoping to find some sort of benediction on pot from Jesus, sort of bought into this notion, and there really isn't any connection much at all. But
drug usage was rampant in Egypt. It was not typically characteristic of Palestine. But drug usage was certainly Roman and Greek, and they used profound amounts of drugs. But to suggest that Jesus had some sort of connection with either drug traffic or drug usage is preposterous.
East of the Rockies, this is probably our last call, And it's a perfect last call, Glenn, because it's where we started with all this. It's Chris in Carbondale, Illinois.
Cool.
Salukis on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball.
Yeah, good show, guys.
You got to speak up, Chris.
Okay. Yeah, I was just asking two really quick questions for you.
Good.
The first one was I'm here in Carbondale, and I was wondering how deep in southern Illinois this new excavation site's going to be.
I will not tell you. But say hi to the Evergreen Terrace for me. I lived there for years.
Okay, and after this site,
you're not far from it. Can I tell you that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
After this site's been excavated and you guys are all moved out of there,
then you can come see the museum.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you bet. Are you a native of Carbondale?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I sold half the buildings on the main street there at one point in time or another.
Yes.
Well. Chris, I'm sure you'll be hearing more about it, if not just on this show.
Without doubt.
But if you all strike gold, as you anticipate doing, and I mean that both figuratively and literally, then you'll be hearing about it a lot more than just on Coast to Coast AM. I think we could probably keep taking callers, but I'm just going to say I appreciate you giving us this opportunity to talk about it before the event, and I know that
it was a little bit of a surprise because I told Lisa about it in confidence, and I know she leaked it to you, which was just fine with me.
And she told you I totally flipped and said, beg him to come on the air to talk about it.
and basically, this is really the province of the Ancient American magazine, and for those of you who would like to get it, that's ancientamerican.com, www.ancientamerican.com. You can find also some of the magazine issues pertaining to this on my website, www.ancientmanuscripts.com. And Wayne May is one of the finest people. He wanted me to give out his phone number for those who are interested in copies of the magazine which describe this particular issue.
Well, go ahead. But
and I'll give him out.
At his peril, go ahead.
Yeah, and this is his problem, so... It's a toll-free number, 877-494-0044.
And the excavation begins in a couple weeks. I would love to make arrangements to be there and at least see as you're bringing up your treasures. How long do you think it will take between when you first begin to drill and you will know what's there in those limestone caverns?
Ian, it's going to take a few days, and that's why I'm suggesting that we will talk and tell you to come at the right time. I don't think anybody, including myself, is going to peek in that hole until they get that thing aired out. And it's going to take them a day or maybe two to get down to the level, and then it's going to take them a little bit of time to shore up the moorings, make sure that the thing isn't going to collapse in on itself before anyone even peeks into this thing. So you know, the timing is of the essence, and if you want to be there when the first things happen, you may not want to be there and wait around while people pour concrete.
Yeah.
But I'll let you know.
Well,
and I'll have to ask permission from Wayne, but I will ask Wayne what he thinks about it, and I will let you know.
Well, I think that'll be terrific, and if I can, I'd love to. And I also want to give a plug to your ancient manuscripts because you really do have some fascinating material, and it's very well put together. And the folders, the binders that you do, it's just great. And for people who are interested in that sort of thing, they really could spend a lot of time picking out several of them and not be disappointed in any of them. I haven't yet read one of them, and I didn't think you put together with great care and consideration for the topic.
Well, you are delightful as always. And, Ian, we are in the future, regardless of what happens this time. We are going to have some fun, you and I.
I would love to do that. We'll go pick out some place to explore gastronomy together. Okay?
Well, gastronomy, but it may be underground.
Well, whatever the cuisine, I'd love to do that. And I appreciate your time and all of the extra attention you gave us on Coast to Coast AM, and I look forward to talking again in the future. And
I'll catch you later then, Ian.
Tomorrow is going to be a great show, too. And we'll talk about Bigfoot, the conclusions that are coming out of the lab, or at least the early indications of this research that so many people have asked for updates on. We have it tomorrow, and we'll do it right out of the box. Don't miss it at Coast to Coast AM. In the meantime, Deus Tiamat, and I do too.